Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody. Welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. We're a member of the Direction Point Doctor Who Podcast Network. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. It's a very busy time for us here in Brooklyn. My daughter's bat mitzvah is coming up very, very soon. Both this week's episode and next week's episode are pre-recorded, so there is no time for my normal news and comments section. This week's episode is a look at Target Book number 93, Planet of Fire, numbered out of order with regards to book 92, The Caves of Androzani, which actually came out a month later. We are covering in publication order on this show, so book 93, Planet of Fire, is episode 92, and book 92, Caves, is episode 93. My guest this week is David Barsky, producer of the show, longtime friend. This was not recorded live in Los Angeles, but rather in September, by video connection. You'll really enjoy what Dave and I have to discuss, which of course is not just limited to Planet of Fire. But I want to preface that with two other pre-recorded segments. Coming up first, Graham Burke was in town last month in New York City. I visited him at his hotel, and we recorded an interview for my ongoing series, What is Your Favorite Doctor Who Story of All Time? Typically, that question is reserved for my guest of the week, but as this is David Barsky's second appearance on the show in 6 weeks, he's already given us his answer. So I figure Graham deserves equal time. Graham will get the segment on this week's David Barsky episode. After my discussion with Graham, which is wide-ranging and a lot of fun, we are going to have a correspondence piece from the godfather of this show, Mark, from the Trap One podcast, who has actually been to Lanzarote and has done the Planet of Fire tour. So Mark has recorded for us a tour, an audio tour, of Lanzarote with backing music that may be familiar to those of you who watch travel shows in the UK. After that, David Barsky and I discuss the Planet of Fire novelization. And after that, I review the novelization itself. This is a jam-packed episode, even without a new segment. So let's get to it.
A Whovian and a Nuvian walk into a TARDIS
and explore every episode of the classic Doctor Who series.
Join me, podcaster John S. Drew,
and me, writer-editor Jim Beard, as we take apart each story starting from the very beginning in 1963.
And join us on our Facebook page and Twitter, where we continue the discussion with you with historical artifacts from British papers of the time. The Doctor's Beard Podcast, released every Saturday around tea time on your favorite podcasting app.
And we'll see you in time and space. You're listening to Doctor Who Literature. Keep turning the pages.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night. And by Saturday night, I mean 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Graham Burke is in town. Graham, welcome back to the show.
It's always great to be here, Jason.
Doing an ongoing series leading up to the 60th anniversary, Greatest Stories of All Time, talking to folks about what is their favorite TV story of all time over the last 60 years. For you, what is your absolute number one favorite Doctor Who TV story between 1963 and the present, and why?
Well, that's a challenging question, but it's a very easy one for me. My favorite is also what I believe to be the best Doctor Who story. It is Pyramids of Mars. It was also the first Doctor Who story I watched. And for me, what I love about it, and the thing I love about it, is the more I learn about how the story came together, the more I feel like this shouldn't be anybody's favorite Doctor Who story ever, because this story was commissioned by one writer who wrote a brief that was all over the map and not very good, and then the script editor had to come in and go do a page one rewrite of it, and he just basically filched from a bunch of bunch of horror things that horror tropes that he liked, and then it was sort of like workshopped by the actors and the director, and the last episode was kind of a Hail Mary, let's just put them through a series of tests idea that the producer Philip Hinchcliffe came up with. And so on paper, this shouldn't work, and yet it works gloriously. And I think it works gloriously for a few reasons. I think, first of all, it works because I think it's really just intelligently done. It's intelligently written. It has, and it because perhaps of the desperation with which they're writing it, they threw everything at it, and everything stuck to the wall miraculously. They decided to finally ask the question. Why don't we just go? We know this didn't affect the future. So why don't we just go and leave? And the doctor takes Sarah to the future of 1980, and discovers that Sutekh has destroyed the world. And it's an amazing moment. And I remember that was probably the very first episode of Doctor Who I'd watched as a teenager. I'd watched a couple as a kid, and I was just like, I'm this show's my favorite from now on. After that scene, it was just a stunning scene. It works because of the chemistry of the doctor and Sarah. Liz Sladen and Tom Baker were just incandescent. They're great performances. I think one of the great things about Doctor Who, and one of the unsung things about Doctor Who, is it's a great place for acting. It's a great show to do big acting and to do fun acting, and they're just so good together. Gabriel Wolfe is great as Sutekh. Bernard Archer is amazing as Scarman. It's got a great performance by Michael Sheard. It's really great. The third reason why I love Pyramids of Mars is it's a story that thinks about all the little details. I think one of my favorite sort of moments in Doctor Who is this little tiny moment at the start when the butler finds Sarah and the doctor. They've come in the TARDIS and they're in a room in this mansion, and he catches them, and the doctor's trying to bluster and say, oh, I think this would be a great place for a paramilitary organization. like he's an estate agent. And he's not having it, The butler isn't having it. He's saying, you're with Dr. Warlock's people and all this stuff. And then he says, I'd leave myself, but situations are hard to come by at my age. Mm. And that line says everything about who this guy is, why he's stuck in this house, which seems to have been taken over by an Egyptian randomly, and has, mummies and God knows what. And, he's just kind of a victim of circumstance. And it gives you this little thing to have sympathy for before he gets brutally murdered. and this is a little moment that Robert Holmes gives to just a throwaway character, and only a show like Doctor Who would do that, as far as I'm concerned. Like, to just sort of have this utterly kind of throwaway moment with a side character who only has four lines, and gets promptly dispatched is beautiful. And it was also a show that sweats the details about these little characters, and it's all the way through that story. I mean, there's lots of wonderful kind of pathos with Michael Sheard and not being able to accept that his brother is effectively dead, and the scene where he shows the photograph of him and his brother in school, and Bernard Archer is just great at he has a residual memory briefly, and it looks like it might work, and then the rug gets pulled out from under you. And
I watch part three every time hoping that Michael Sheard is going to pull through, and of course he never does. No, but I'm always hoping against hope.
No, exactly. And it's just a brilliant bit of characterization, and that was really thoughtful. Every character has got is wonderfully motivated. I love the ending of episode two, which is that Michael Sheard's character sabotages what the doctor's trying to do to stop Sutekh, and it's and you know he's got, every character has got their clear motivations, and I love, and then they all intersect, and that's really great drama. And the last thing I really love about Pyramids of Mars is it's, perhaps because of the desperation in which it was made, it is such a stunning inversion of the Doctor Who format. The Doctor Who format is, especially during that time, it's the TARDIS arrives in a place, there's a mystery, there's a gradual reveal of the mystery, and then eventually they stop the villain. Pyramids inverts that. Pyramids has the reveal of the villain being made within the first 8 minutes of the story. The Doctor realizes it's Sutekh. The rest of the story is spent attempting to repel Sutekh and trying different means to repel Sutekh and failing to do so because of all the intersections of the characters. And then, you know, once the Doctor does manage to, you know, make one last really great attempt at it, he fails again. And he's only manages to actually save humanity through the skin of his teeth. And I love that about it. I love that it's a great inversion of the Doctor Who format, and it does it so really well. But, you know, on paper, this story should not work, and yet it does.
And I want to give a shout-out to Patty Russell. You don't have a lot of female directors in the 70s. Her casting list, she takes so many actors who had been guest performers during the Hartnell era and brings them back to the show for the first time in a decade. So you have Bernard Archer had been in Power of the Daleks. Mm-hmm. Michael Shear goes all the way back to the Ark. Michael Bilton, who plays the friendly neighborhood doctor who doesn't last very long, was in The Massacre.
Yeah.
It's a great show to watch to find out what the performances of folks would have been like in lost episodes from the 60s.
Yeah. I think her casting is spot on. I think the other thing that she does really well is she's... The film work in that story is so good. Like, the film work, building tension with very lumbering things. But there's some interesting notes that I think she's given to the actors to do things. Like, one of my favorite moments with Sarah is the moment when she's got the shotgun, or she's got the rifle rather, and she's supposed to like fire at this thing, and the doctor says to her, the doctor says, you just do your thing well, and she picks up the gun and starts aiming and says, don't worry, I know what I'm doing, and the way she delivers it is just like, I believe her. Like, she, Sarah has never shown any handiness with weaponry before, but I absolutely believe it, and I gather that, you know, she didn't, Patty Russell was not a director who got on well with actors, but I think they just, I think she got the most out of like Liz Sladen in that moment, and several moments. I think her casting of Gabriel Wolfe as Sutekh is brilliant. It's just totally counterintuitive casting. So yeah, that really worked for me as well.
One of the things I love about Sarah Jane is that usually a companion is there to get a subplot of their own. Mm-hmm. They team up with a second member of the Resistance, or they have some side quest. Sarah Jane, with certain exceptions, doesn't get individual subplots. She is there with the Doctor, the Tom Baker Doctor, in every scene, and she is there to serve as his hype man and his Tom Baker to English translator. Huh. He'll give some wacky, wild-eyed pronunciation, and she will explain it for the purpose of Lawrence Scarman.
Yeah.
And then she is not afraid to call him out. He says, I walk in eternity, and she gives him a mocking rejoinder.
Oh, I'm a Time Lord.
He dresses up as a mummy, and she goes, must have been a terrible accident.
Don't provoke me.
Yeah.
But there's just great banter between them. And like, one of my all-time favorite Doctor and Sarah scenes is when they were... is when they're in the poacher's cabin and she tosses him some jelly knife, sweaty jelly knife, is highly unstable, and she's just so like, oops, but she's just so charming and wonderful and confident, and they just have a great banter with each other. You know, she says, you know, she at one point, you know, she says, are you going to keep on looking? Are you going to help out, or are you going to keep looking down? She says, your shoes need cleaning. And I just love that. I just love that kind of easy banter they have. And the one nice thing is that they just had a really great professional relationship. I gather it kind of like they just kind of didn't, it didn't translate to any kind of a personal relationships outside the studio, but they put their friendship all into the actual characters. And there's this wonderful moment in episode 4 when they wheel into the room and then they see that there's a mummy and they wheel out and they just turn, and it's based on a move in a Marx Brothers movie. Mm-hmm. And I think Tom and Liz had the idea they wanted to do it, and I gathered that Patty Russell was not particularly enamored with it, but they put it in anyway. And I just think these are two people working in sync like nobody's business.
And the gif of that, where you can watch that over and over again every 7 seconds, is absolute internet gold.
Oh, it is. It is. So yeah, I really rate highly the relationship of Tom Baker and Liz Sladen, and it's my favorite doctor companion relationship, I think. And some of that is just the alchemy of two really great actors. Stephen Moffat once said that if Tom Baker had been cast as the Doctor in say 2005 as opposed to 1975, he would have done the role for 3 years, and then he would have been on to like American shows. He would have been like basically Benedict Cumberbatch or Matt Smith. And the funny thing is that Moffat said this before he'd done either Sherlock or Doctor Who. But he understood it. He understood that, you know, the dynamics in the 70s was you just kept on working as a working actor. But Tom Baker was that good to have been a star. He would have been a star. Like, and to a certain extent, I feel like him and Liz Sladen, if they had done it like 30 years later, both it would have been like Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman. They would have been on to American films, and they would have been on to very prestige productions, because they were both that good as actors. They were both really great. Liz Sladen has a wonderful warmth and an intuitive sense of a scene that is absolutely brilliant. And you know, I think one of the greatest things Russell T. Davies did for the modern series was bring back Sarah Jane, and not just as a cameo, but to give her like her own focus for an episode, and then give her an actual series, because Liz Sladen deserved that.
And that series ran 6 years and only stopped when she passed away. Yeah, it's a fun series. Yeah. The one last point I'll bring up about Pyramids is you mentioned the sweaty Jellic Knight scene.
Yeah, yeah.
How does that scene end? The Doctor cannot find a detonator.
Yeah.
Sarah responds, "Maybe he sneezed." Graham, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jason.
Have a safe flight home.
Hello, this is Mark from the Trap One podcast. I was lucky enough to visit Lanzarote earlier this year and found some locations from Planet of Fire. The locations are dotted around the island, so we found the easiest way to see everything was to hire a little car. I'd recommend this even if you just want to see as much of the island as possible, or find a Cro-Magnon cave to explore with an octogenarian from Miami Beach. If you do decide to get around by car, remember, they drive on the wrong side of the road. I'd say the main location to visit is Mirador del Rio, a building on the northern coast of the island. This was built in the early 70s into the rock. What's great about visiting here is that it's a bona fide tourist attraction, so if, like me, you're travelling with someone who has no interest in Doctor Who filming locations, you can pass it off as an architectural marvel that also affords amazing views and serves a good bocadillo. Mirador del Rio is the building that can be seen very early in part 1 of Planet of Fire. Timonov and Malcolm stroll along a corridor and into a room that has ferns hanging around the walls and a large metal decoration suspended from the ceiling, while they discuss the merits of burning unbelievers. What's extraordinary is that 40 years later the ferns and the ceiling installation are both still there. Makes it very easy to recognise the room. The hallway they walk along is your way in from the entrance and the ticket booth, and the large room where they sit down is a cafe. When we return to Timonov and Malcolm, they are outside on a walkway with views across a stretch of water to another small island. you can climb up to the roof of the Mirador del Rio and get this view yourself. On screen, the camera pans to the right across this scene a little and stops just before it would reveal a cluster of houses on the small island of La Graciosa across the way. The walkway they are standing on itself is accessible from inside the cafe and runs around the outside of its large windows. The views from here are stunning over the Strait of El Rio and the island opposite. Mirador del Rio is open every day from 10 a.m. until 5:45 or 6:45 in the summer months. Entry is only €4.74, which is £4.13 in sterling, or $5. Although you can buy a package of tickets which includes access to other attractions like the Volcano Museum. From there, if you head east across the top of the island, you reach a small town called Ozola. This is a tougher sell to take a not-wee to. It's a charming little town, but there's not much to see except the jetty, which is where Howard's boat docks to bring aboard the Statue of Eros and the Trion Beacon. Then on the south of the island is the beautiful Papageo Beach, where Turlu rescues Perry from the sea. This is a really beautiful spot and well worth a visit. Then, in the Timanfaya National Park on the west coast of the island, are the Montañas del Fuego, the Mountains of Fire, where the scenes of characters wandering around the planet of San are filmed. You can't explore this by yourself. There's a tour on a bus that takes you around part of it after queuing for quite a long time in your car to get in. I'd advise getting there early. My guess is that the scenes on the surface for Kill the Moon were also filmed there. That's my very rough guide to Planet of Fire filming locations. Now back to Jason in the studio.
Oh boy, I can't wait to talk about this one. Yep.
A few short weeks ago, David Barsky, I was sitting in your home office / library in sunny Cal, the beautiful San Fernando Valley. Now I am huddling in the dark Brooklyn evening on the first day of autumn while you are still luxuriating in your library. How are you, my friend?
I'm still reminiscing about the times we had, Jason. It was
that was quite an afternoon. Never to be duplicated in the annals of male bonding.
Yes, of course. God, I felt like there was so much more I wanted to say about Inferno 2, but how much can you say? It's such a great story, and I did enjoy the book. So,
well, I will tell you that when I was talking to Andrew Smith for an episode a few weeks ago, he enjoyed the Inferno episode very much, and he is a big fan of yours, so let that sink in. The man who wrote Full Circle is a big fan of you. He did not quite understand our mutual love for Inferno, but he decided to watch it again on our recommendation, and the early results are he enjoys it much more this time. So thanks to us, Inferno is now cool across the board.
Yes, the power of pressure in fandom cannot be underestimated. No, he's a really great guy. He probably doesn't even recall, but I met him at Gallifrey One when he was here a few years back, and you know, I participated. We were out in the patio, and he had all these, you know, dialogue questions. He'd read a line of dialogue, and we had to guess what story it was from. And, you know, it was really fun. He had some really tough ones too, and some really obscure things. I mean, he was picking stuff from like the Faceless Ones and things like that. Like nobody was getting, but we were just huddled out there, and, you know, at night, and it was really fun. He's a good guy. And by coincidence, he and I have the same birthday, per date, I should say. We weren't born the same year, but anyways, I should reacquaint myself with him and say hi. He's a good guy.
He is an absolute mensch. I was very happy to have him on the show, and I can tell you for sure he will be back for a future episode.
Excellent. Excellent. I wasn't thinking. I don't know if I said that on the podcast or not, but I told you I always meant to say you should hit him up for the Full Circle episode, and I never suggested that to you. I was going to text you. I kept meaning to, and I never did. And now, lo and behold, he probably would have done it. That would have been cool.
I mean, Jim Sangster absolutely crushed and annihilated and excelled in that episode. It's hard to imagine recording that episode without Jim. But if I ever go back and do a redux, I will certainly do that episode again with the actual author.
Yeah, no, I'd never take away anything from Jim Sangster. I mean, man, he's a brilliant guy. But Jesus, that's a great idea. Maybe once you record the last episode, you just start it all from the top with different guests for every book.
See, I once figured out that thanks to the marketing wing of the British Broadcasting Corporation, I own 7 different versions of Spearhead from Space, not counting the two copies of the novelization Doctor Who and the Auton Invasion, if they can keep selling me Spearhead from Space over and over again and I keep buying it, off-air VHS tape, commercial VHS tape, 2001 DVD release, special edition DVD release, Blu-ray only release, and then, of course, the Season 7 box set, whenever that comes out. If I can keep buying Spearhead from Space until the cows come home, if I have more copies of Spearhead from Space than Jane Austen wrote novels, I can certainly do a revisitations of Doctor Who literature and do the entire run through again starting in 2025. But I want to do my Hartnell podcast first, so maybe that'll wait until 2027 or 2028.
Jeez, I hate to break this to you, Jason, but you may be controlled by the Nestine consciousness. I don't know. Just a suggestion.
Considering all the microplastics I've ingested over the years, I am probably 75% Nestine, 20% Homo sapiens, and 5% Neanderthal.
I won't tell you. You'll have to do, what is that, 23andMe to really figure that out, though.
Well, 23andMe says that I have a little less Neanderthal DNA than the average Homo sapiens. So whatever happened on the family tree, we came from a non-Neanderthal valley.
Well, I had the most boring one ever. It was the most predictable thing. I was so disappointed. The most enlightening thing of mine came back was I was 0.08% Ashkenazi Jew.
Wait, how much again?
0.08.
You are coming to our shul next month, we are going to give you a bar mitzvah. That is enough to be in the tribe. You know how much Ashkenazi I am?
How much?
85%. Now, I didn't need an expensive test to tell me that. I could look in the mirror and say that I'm 85% Ashkenazi.
Well, my wife actually married into she married me. She actually her mother married into a Jewish family, and she has cousins who are literally their last name is Ashkenazi. So, and it's amazing. Who knows what percentage they are? They might be the original lineage. Who knows? I don't know.
The progenitors, you might say.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting, those DNA tests. There's a Doctor Who fan friend of mine from the East Coast who now lives in Los Angeles and plies her trade at the stand-up game. Polish Catholic, very proud of being Polish Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
She ran her DNA test on the same service that mine was done. Turns out, not only is she 50% Ashkenazi, but she is also my third cousin genetically.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yeah, mine was boring as heck. You know, I knew that I was half Irish and half Polish and didn't tell me elsewise, really.
What part of Ireland are you from?
I believe County Cork.
County Cork.
Here's the thing. That's where my dad's family was from, but it just by happenstance, my mom's family is half Irish on her father's side, and her mother is half Polish. On my father's side, though, he's half Polish on his father's side and half Irish on his mother's side. So one of my grandmothers was from County Cork. I don't know where the O'Briens are from. I could probably find out somehow. I mean, there's lots of people I know who do, what's ancestry.com, and could probably figure that out.
See, I have a lot of family from Poland, so it is quite possible that 500 years ago, one of your Polish ancestors interbred with one of my ancestors, and that 0.8% Ashkenazi might be the same 0.8% that I'm carrying in my blood.
It could be, yeah. A lot of the Jews migrated from persecution and, from Prague area up to Poland. And actually, one of the first things I did in Poland when I visited in 2018, we went to the Jewish Museum there. And it was really, really great experience. Fascinating history. It was like medieval history of
20 years ago, there were shtetl tours. You could go back and walk the earth that your grandparents were kicked out of when they were tossed out of the country violently 100 years ago. Mm. My grandmother came from the same area of Poland that Martha Stewart has ancestry in, or as I call her, cousin Martha. And she came here in 1920, and makes my father first generation and makes me second generation American because my grandmother was the immigrant. But I don't know. You probably come from several parts of Poland, given that you have multiple great-great-grandparents.
Yeah, the only one I do know of is my mother's family came from Gdansk in the north of Poland, and which is a city we did not visit while I was there. So I guess I'll have to go back. And we didn't even go to Cork either when I was when we were in Ireland a couple of months ago. So, hey, there's always it'll be there, I'm sure, next time. I'm sure, you know, everybody gives you suggestions when you're planning a trip. And I was like, half the people, oh, you got to go to Cork. It's amazing. I was like, yeah, I want to, but there's so much else we want to do.
Well, speaking of DNA tests and this week's Doctor Who episode, Planet of Fire. Now, a lot of different demands were placed on it by the production offices in the means of serving as a culmination of multiple years-long story arcs. But at heart, it is Peter Grimwade working out family therapy with his deeply religious man-of-the-cloth father. The character of Timonov, who, number one, bears a striking resemblance to 1980s New York Yankees manager Billy Martin. Although half my audience not knowing what I'm talking about, Peter Wingard himself was of Jewish origin. So the fiery preacher character Timonov, based on Peter Grimwade's father, is played by an actor of Jewish descent. We are all one family, or as my people would say, we are all one mishpacha.
Yeah, well, although Wingard was a fascinating character, he was in denial about everything. He constantly fabricated his origins and, he changed his name and all that kind of stuff. You know, supposedly, was it born in France, but he was born in Singapore. But no, it's fairly well documented that he is Jewish, although at the time of his life, I think he was trying to avoid that fact for some reason.
Many people tried to hide that fact, and for very good reasons, for much of the 20th century.
Yeah. God, I was going to bring this up so far, but have you ever heard his music, quote unquote?
I have never heard the quote unquote music of Peter Wingard. Given his speaking voice, I can't imagine that he was particularly melodious.
No, he came out with an album in 1970, the year of my birth. So I got curious a while back ago about it because I love him in certain things. I mean, you know, he was in, you know, Prisoner, of course, as a number two. And, you know, and this is like the second time Peter Davison has met a number two from The Prisoner. So he's got a good lineage there, of course, but he came out with an album in 1970 and it's sort of this, you know, bumbling melody as you've guessed, but there's also some spoken word, but there's also a song which could never be done today. And I'm not even going to say what the name, I'll spell it out to you. The song is called R.A.P.E. And I am not kidding you. The fact that the song starts off with him, shouting that word in different tones of voice. And I got to tell you, it is the least offensive thing about the song.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
Yes.
I've said it before and I'll say it again.
Yeah. No, you know, this is the problem. All these drugged up actors in the 70s really thought they could do anything. And they continually prove themselves wrong.
I mean, William Shatner's rendition of Rocket Man is absolute comedy gold.
Oh, American classic. Without a doubt. American classic.
And then Leonard Nimoy recorded multiple record albums. Now, you get to the 1980s and Don Johnson is recording record albums. Vanity is also one hell of a drug.
Yeah, I dare you to listen to that song. It is on YouTube. I believe I heard it then when I first sought it out. I dare you.
Well, coming back to Planet of Fire, if you were to rank your favorite Doctor Who seasons, right off the top of your head, free association, for me, Season 7, Season 18, Season 2. For you, what are your favorite Doctor Who seasons?
Well, you know, like I've said many times before, there's, you know, off the top is that cluster of Hinchcliffe seasons, you know. I mean, you know, 13, 14, you know, even 12, I love Season 7, of course. The season that this is in is up there. Frontios was always one of my favorite Davison stories, along with Visitation, Modern Undead. And I really never appreciated a lot of this season. I think I used to like Caves and Androzani more than I do now. You know, then we got the Twin Dilemma. You know, the weird thing about that is, you know, everybody hates Twin Dilemma, everybody loves Caves. And the problem is, you know, Caves is also well known as the direction is wonderful. And it had to be, because it is some of the cheapest looking sets you've seen since season 6 on this show. I mean, seriously, I mean, that spaceship that the Doctor crashes in, the smuggle ship, it's like you haven't seen a more cheap, barren set than, you know, since the Dominators, really. So I think what they did, though, you look at Twin Dilemma. The Twin Dilemma has amazing models, has amazing costumes. It has all kinds of cool sets. But, you know, the story isn't really great. I think they really put more money in the final thing for the final, you know, serial of the season for their new Doctor to give them a good launch. And they kind of cheapened out on that. But the story was there, you know, although it's, you know, a lot of retreading from all the stuff Holmes has done. So I think, you know, those last two serials of that season kind of diminish it for me.
The space station walls in Twin Dilemma are wood paneled. That is a fine level of detail, not out of place in season 2 of Fargo. The couch that the Colin Baker Doctor leaps over effortlessly in part 2 could have come out of an Anthropology catalog. When I am asked to say one nice thing about Twin Dilemma, the interior decorating is always my answer. Parts of the story are very nice to look at before Mestor shows up. But even though this season is bookended by the Mirka and by Mestor, in the middle you have The Awakening, criminally underrated.
Yes.
Frontios is playing in a class by itself in terms of dialogue. It is not fair to the other stories that Frontios has written so well.
I love it.
Resurrection of the Daleks, my first Dalek story. I have said terrible things about Eric Sayward on this program, and I am going to do it again when his own books come up, especially the 21st century books. I am a big fan of Resurrection. I will never say a bad thing about it, even though Sayward himself evidently hates it. Planet of Fire, again, I started watching the show with season 20. By the time season 21 rolled around, I was hooked. I was a fiend. I was an addict. I was like Secker on Vraxoan for most of season 21, airing at 7 p.m. on weeknights on PBS, Channel 21, Garden City, New York. I loved every minute of Planet of Fire, and it was a blow to the gut to join the internet in the 1990s and the early 21st century and to learn this story was not very well loved. For me, there's nothing wrong with Planet of Fire at all. I enjoy every minute. I enjoy every twist. And in fact, the fact that the producers made Grimway to add all this stuff. You have to write in Perry. You have to write out Turlough. You have to write out Chameleon. You have to write out the Master. You've got to bring Turlough full circle. All that stuff works to the story's benefit because there are so many great individual scenes in that story. Plus, the director is Fiona Cumming. Plus, shooting both the volcanic ash and the beaches of Lanzarote. I think that works for the story.
I think it does. I think Fiona is generally a good director. I don't think she served the landscape very well, though. I think there's too many wide shots that look just too barren, emptiness. And I guess that's kind of the point, but it's not really visually interesting. I think as well recounted in this era of Doctor Who, the directors did the shooting script, and they left the actors to their own devices. And I think she did well with Davison as an actor in all the episodes she did. But, oh my God, what the heck are Nicola Bryant and Dallas Adams doing and their scenes together? It sounds like they're literally at a table read. It sounds awful. And I don't know if they're encumbered by their newly acquired American accents or what, but it's so bad.
Well, Dallas Adams is Australian, and Nicola Bryant was given the note, your American accent needs to sound more Australian. So they were definitely on the wrong continent. Yeah. Dallas Adams is a very small part of the story, and as I get older, I sympathize with his character more and more. If you are the father of a very headstrong older teenage girl, and your authority is slipping away very, very quickly, like grains of sand through your fingers, what else are you supposed to do? So... I like his character, and yes, Dallas Adams is not the best performance we've seen on the show, but he's also gone after episode 1. Episode 1 cliffhanger, I will ask you right off the bat, has Anthony Ainley ever given a better line reading than the part 1 cliffhanger? I don't think so.
Probably not. I think this is one of Ainley's best performances. I think that's one of the great things about Anthony Ainley as a master. He gets better almost every performance he does. I mean, you know, a lot of people think Survival is his best, but he's great here. He really is. I mean, I think Grimwade does a lot, and you know, we'll get to this when we talk about the book itself, but it's interesting what he chooses to add and subtract from the novelization. And it's, and the dialogue in the novelization is even better. Some of the turns of phrases he used and descriptors he used are just brilliant. I love his writing. I honestly think this is the best book I've read for this podcast.
It is a laugh out loud book. When I was 12 and I was 13 and I was reading this book on long Saturday afternoon shopping trips, following my mother as she was trying on boots and skirts and all sorts of stuff in stores that I would never go to today. I was sitting there reading this book. I was genuinely amused by a lot of, as you say, the turns of phrase. He's very witty. The way the doctor keeps thinking about Professor Foster long after they've parted company because he wants the archaeologist's input. Mm-hmm. The way that Timonov and his colleagues are called arthritic Ayatollahs. That's a laugh out loud funny line.
I love that. That's hilarious. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. And he introduced me to some British slang I've never even heard of, in this book. I'm like, wow. What was it? Crocodile for, a line of parading people or generally school children. You know, he uses that. I've never even heard that. And there was one other. What the heck was it? I can't remember. Oh, milksop.
Yes.
You know, I guess it's like milk toast, but I've never heard milksop before.
I think milktoast appears in the book as well, come to think of it.
No, does it? I don't remember it. I was just so enamored with milksop. Oh my God, I'm going to be using that one in the future.
The cover of the book, this is a remarkably evocative cover. You got the blue flame, you got Anthony Ainley, you have Chameleon in the background. This is a great cover.
Yeah, no, I love it. And you know, I think I told you, unbeknownst to me, I bought this on eBay several months ago, and my copy is autographed by the cover model, Anthony Ainley.
I had
no idea that was the case when I bought it, because they didn't say that in the listing on eBay.
That's going to quadruple the price on eBay.
Sure.
Now you got to get it signed by John Sim and Sacha Devon and Michelle Gomez.
Yeah, there's a whole collection. Yeah.
So this is one of these endless Saturday morning shopping trips. My mother would go to like 7 or 8 different stores shopping out her new wardrobe, and I was carrying around my Doctor Who novelization of the week, standing by the front of the store, kind of forlorn, reading, waiting for her to finish. And I was a small child. So when I was 11 years old, I could still pass for 7 or 8. And one of the teenage store clerks sees me looking at the front of the store all bored and tries to make conversation. "Hey, young man, what book are you reading?" So I flash her the cover, and she blanches and she turns to her colleague at the counter. "I thought it was going to be like Garfield." I frightened some 17-year-old store clerk in Long Island, New York, by showing her a photo of Anthony Ainley half green and on fire.
Did they even know what Doctor Who was, though? Probably not.
Almost certainly not, yeah. Unless they were watching. These were not Channel 21 watchers. These were Golden Girls watchers.
Yeah, okay then.
Which was the style at the time. When did you first see Planet of Fire?
Oh my, I remember it well.
I can remember everything as if it were yesterday. We met at 9.
We met at 8.
I was on time.
No, you were late.
Ah, yes? I remember it well.
The year was 1985. Oh, and
Wow, I actually saw this story before you did.
Maybe. I 84, 85, I remember it well, but it was probably when it first broadcast in Boston. So maybe it was 84. I don't know. But I do remember being a young adolescent on the verge of manhood. And then one day a bikini clad vision and by the name of Nicole O'Brien appeared on my TV screen to help me finally cross a certain threshold. I should probably stop there, really.
Yeah, I think we don't want to go down that road any further. I was only 11 years old, and it was a couple of years away before I discovered the women who made my head swoon. Nicola Bryan, not one of them. However, nothing takes away from the fact that she has a great entrance in this story, because she basically carries part one by herself. She has her own thing going on while the Doctor and Turlough are busy. Those are pretty good fight scenes, even though, as you say, the acting performances by her and Dallas Adams are kind of table ready.
I honestly, yeah, but I also found her incredibly annoying. In that first episode, you know, screaming Howie and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And the drowning, you know, when she's trying to swim to shore. It's and again, you know, going to the novel, Grimway does a great job of giving her more agency, more of a reason why she's encumbered. You know, first of all, you know, if you ever swam and, you know, out that far from the shore, it's difficult. And, you know, even the waves don't look that, that, you know, terrible in that scene. It's hard. It's really hard. You got to use a lot of energy. Swimming is a tough endeavor out there.
And Grimwade on page 30 describes her arm motions as she drowns as frantic semaphores.
Yes. Again, a great turn of phrase that he uses. I love a lot what he does. He gives a lot more background and a lot more agency to the characters. He, you know, and he also injects a lot of, you know, more, you know, classical references to help you understand. And, you know, as far as, you know, painting a picture, not only that, but, you know, just deepening and enriching the narrative. This is a great novel, man.
Chapter one of the book is basically the prologue, and it adds two fictional scenes that were not on television. They take place worlds apart, but they are both on doomed spaceships. I think this prologue is one of the unsung Target prologues. I don't hear folks talking about how great it is, but I love the fact that he contrasts the sinking Greek merchant ship, yep, with the prison shuttle breaking up over Sarn. Now, from an astrophysics standpoint, the rescue beacon landing on Earth, possibly not very realistic, but threading them together in the prologue is a remarkably nifty bit of writing.
Yeah. I never really quite took it, though, that the beacon was from that actual ship. I know that, you know, he kind of insinuates it, but I didn't take that. I mean, now that you say it, I think, you know, I believe he might have insinuated that, but I just assumed it was just from another ship, because we do know that there are agents on Earth.
True. That's a possible point. And we meet one of those agents in this story. And we also learn there was a reference to the very eccentric solicitor on Chancery Lane, yeah, in Modern Undead. And this explains that reference a year later, which is also a nice bit of forward plotting.
Well, no, it's great that, you know, he was able to, you know, finish Turtle's arc as it was his character first written in, you know, Modern Undead, right? And also Chameleon's arc, you know, Chameleon had, you know, a terrible time for obvious reasons. You know, it didn't really work out. You know, the instrument that was Chameleon, the robot, did not work very well. But, you know, it started on, you know, the Xerophon with you know, Time Flight, which, you know, Grimway directed. But he also connects it very well, you know, very well in both the televised show and the novel, and ends his arc very well. I think his demise is kind of sad and gruesome a little bit, but, you know, he probably was just hated, completely hated Chameleon, who wasn't in, of course, Time Flight, but that's where he supposedly came from.
In 1997 or 1998, I was at John Blum and Kate Orman's wedding in suburban Washington, D.C., and I was sharing a room with our mutual friend, Stacy Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Stacy had brought a stack of what was then the brand new BBC Books Past Doctor Adventures novels, which began life in 1997. I had not acquired a lot of these books yet, and I started flipping through one of the books. It's a Sixth Doctor and Perry book, but I won't say which one. And I get to the – I was flipping too far to the back of the book, and I said, wow, Chameleon's in this? And that ended up being a major plot spoiler, and Stacy was mad at me for several minutes.
Wow.
But, yes, yeah, somebody took it into their head that Chameleon needed a nether, stronger exit. So in this book, it is posited that Chameleon's mind survives inside the TARDIS and latches onto a nether robot and pursues the Doctor and Perry for most of the story, and finally reveals itself in the final chapter before dying again. But this is a happy, fun death where everyone is all together. So somebody watched the story and said, wait, there's more Chameleon stories that have to be told.
And that's why they call it fan fiction. You know, I don't know. As much of a failure the whole concept of Chameleon was, I mean, it was an interesting idea. I'll give them that. But I don't know. You don't need to retroactively do more with a character like him, I don't think. I mean, they could have done so much more on screen. They didn't have to be tied to the robot. You know, he could have morphed into anybody and done. You know, you think about that. It's like literally, though, as controlled by the master, Chameleon is like the second nemesis the Doctor has from the inside, you know, Turlough being the first. And it's just like the poor Fifth Doctor had so much stacked against him.
Yeah, so Peter Grimwade eulogizes Tegan at the beginning of the story, talking about a, quote, voice that could strip paint. He describes her as argumentative, tactless, interfering, and brainless. Brainless is a bridge too far.
That's a little harsh, yes, absolutely.
But other great turns of phrase in this book, you have Canine's cheerful robot loyalty. I love that this is season 21 and Canine's been gone for 3.5 years and the writers are still talking about him.
Yeah.
And then he describes Chameleon as a tin pot Jeeves. That's great. Oh. I couldn't come up with that in a million years.
No, that's, and I particularly, he adds a line, and I think he does a great job after the master is revealed as a puny idiot, you know, stuck in his own prison. But when, Amiens wants to kill the master. He says, kill him, Doctor. And he adds the line describing the Doctor as a second rank crippled by second rank something or other crippled by moral scruple. That line's not in the TV show, but I thought it was brilliant.
And there's so much of that going on. You have Edward Highmore playing Malcon. His son is now, of course, a big US TV star with The Good Doctor. That's a nice little bit of TV lineage carrying forward.
No, I got a little bit. I got a little bit in this episode for you too. I'm not carrying forward, but historically, I'm not familiar with that show you just named, so I haven't seen him. But Dallas Adams was in a really fun movie called The Abominable Dr. Fibes as a constable. And there was somebody else credited as a constable who was in Doctor Who in that same film. Who was it?
And I'm not going to go to Wikipedia to look this up, but now I'm going to require a hint.
He was a companion of the Doctor at one point.
Hmm. Well, when you say he was a companion, there aren't too many. What year did The Abominable Dr. Fibes come out?
Early 70s.
Well, if it's somebody who became a companion later on, probably not Ian Martyr, by process of elimination, would that be a very young Mark Strickson?
No, it was Ian Martyr.
Ian Martyr, yes. Okay.
Did I say he became – did I really say became – I didn't say he was one. I don't think he said it because you could have guessed, anybody – well, you could have guessed, Jamie or Ian.
My brain interpreted it as somebody who had become a companion later on. Maybe you didn't say that in words, but you said it in your demeanor and in the dark, inner, murky workings of my brain.
Yep. Well, hey, you were half right in trying to eliminate him, I guess.
My wrong answer was correct.
Yes.
Peter Davison gets out of his costume, looks terrific walking around in his, we call them suspenders. They're properly called braces in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Looks very good in shirt sleeves. Mark Strickson gets out of the suit jacket. I like stories where the characters are dressed casual or out of their usual JNT imposed attire, which is also why Black Orchid is nice, because you have Davison in that silk bathrobe, you have Davison in the clown costume, you have Davison not wearing his Doctor Who outfit for most of the story.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it was refreshing, though, when Tegan and Nyssa also changed outfits, in the next season they were in, so that was very helpful.
I also like the friction between the Doctor and Turlough. The Doctor threatening Turlough with the end of their friendship at one point. Now, again, Tegan has just left, a week ago in story terms, because they're showing, the story is aired over 2 weeks in season 21. So by the time part four airs, it's only been 2 weeks to the day since Tegan left. I don't miss Tegan when I watch the story. I think Turlough adds so much to the story. And Mark Strickson is such an underrated performer.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have the immediate interest of Nicola Bryant, who maybe her bikini is doing a lot of the work in this story, but she makes a big impression. And there's really no time to miss Janet Fielding in this story. And that's a good compliment.
Well, that's absolutely true. Yeah, yeah, you mentioned Nicola's bikini, but I think Mark Strickson's shorts are probably doing way too much work.
When this aired when I was in college and I was making my off-air VHS copy in 1994, one of my roommates was scandalized by what I was watching. The man in the Speedo is standing over the girl in the bikini. They thought it was the Playboy Channel, perhaps, to which one of my college roommates was a subscriber.
No, no, never did myself. Never indulged.
Never. I'm quite positive.
Although I did submit a resume when I first moved to Los Angeles.
You never went to the Hefner Mansion?
No, I have many friends who've been there, though.
Well, somebody in my household is working on a TV series right now with the word Playboy in the title, so... You got you TV producers work in rarefied circles.
Well, what can I say? We draw short straws sometimes.
It's a dirty job. Oh, wait, never mind. Yeah. You've already done that. 7 years worth. Getting back to Planet of Fire. Other great things about this story. I think Peter Wingard gives a really good performance, but what's fascinating is the way that Peter Wingard leaves the story on TV is the opposite of the way that Peter Wingard leaves the story in the book. And I much prefer the novelization. I think it's a much better, and even if this is Grimley working out a lot of angst over his upbringing, I think the book is a much better solution. That's my headcanon. The book is real. The TV is not.
Well, you know, I'm not going to say that, but I do agree. I mean, like I said, I really think Grimley improves a lot, you know, in this novelization. I think he, you know, explains more of the character's motivations. I think he actually makes, and again, I think it's not necessarily the direction here, but when Perry is chasing the master around, the way it is written in the book, she's far more fearsome. I'm like, oh my God, she's going to smack the master like a bug with her shoe. And, you know, it's like two pages long. And the problem with it on television, it's not necessarily the direction, but the editing, which, you know, I believe at this time in Doctor Who was also up to the director, but it intercuts with, you know, what's going on with the Doctor and the denizens of Sarn, with, you know, Perry trying to chase him around. And it's a great sequence in the book. And, you know, and even in the on television, they cut away to her sneezing. So it distracts her from chasing him and he gets away. It's so ridiculous.
Well, the pacing of the book is also different. I would have to imagine the book is based on Grimwade's final submission, because in the book, the characters on Sarn really don't show up. The characters climbing the volcano don't show up until page 36, chapter 4. In fact, they show up on the same page as the word milksop, to bring us back to an earlier stage of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Whereas Roskell and Amian show up much earlier on TV before we have much of a context. I think the structure of the book makes more sense, and that was later altered, probably by Fiona Cumming or Eric Sayward. But the book brings you in, I think, at a much more gradual and logical pace.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I guess I do like about that, you kind of, you know, you talked about, you know, characters moving around and stuff like that, but I think the Doctor, you know, it's funny, in some cases he makes the Doctor look better in the novelization, but another he makes him more adversarial, you know, especially towards Turlough, I believe, you know, like at one point, you know, when he's, you know, when Turlough is realizing what's happening on Sarn, you know, he's like, oh, okay, we help Trions, and, you know, the Sarns we don't, you know, and he calls him racialist, and I mean, that's not in the televised serial, of course. And there's a few other moments like that, but he, you know, but in the beginning when he's quote unquote bragging, you know, showing off about identifying the artifacts that are in the truck, you know, and Turlough points that out, he eliminates that dialogue of Turlough pointing it out. So, you know, it's weird. He makes some interesting choices with the Doctor, and that go either way, where I think every other character in the book, he really improves.
Yeah. It's kind of the way they made the show. The location scenes were not rehearsed, so it was almost, to a large sense, ad-libbing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's also, again, going back to the editing, I can only imagine there was a lot cut out, but I think the episode one moves a little too fast. And there's like a few things that aren't explained very well. And, you know, how we got from point A to point B. Although there's some nice touches, you know, of course, with the doctor throwing the alien coins down as he's hurrying away from the cafe. But again, he eliminates that humor in the book. He says he throws coins down, but he doesn't say that they're alien, you know?
Right. Peter Davison was looking to inject humor wherever he could. That was almost certainly a Peter Davison suggestion. Yeah. But we shouldn't get to Sarn until the doctor does. And in the book, we don't get to Sarn until the doctor does. Right. So I prefer that a little more than, not to say anything bad about the TV. These are minor comparisons rather than actual legitimate grievances. But we've talked about Timonov. We've talked a little bit about Malkon. Malkon being Turlough's brother is perhaps too neat of a coincidence, but British literature is full of coincidences where everybody winds up related to everybody else.
Oh, yeah, it's completely Dickensian. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah, the last few chapters of Great Expectations. Every single character is a blood relative of every other single character.
Yeah, it happened in Oliver Twist as well.
Never finished Oliver Twist. I'll have to make that one of my next projects.
Oh, God, I ruined it for you. Damn, I'm so sorry.
That hardly counts as a spoiler for a 200-year-old book.
Yeah, you never know.
It's hard to get past all the stuff about Fagin and Oliver Twist, although Dickens had Jewish friends who complained to him while the novel was halfway done, so reportedly Fagin is not quite so horrible in the second half of the book. But I never got that far.
Going back to an early part of the conversation, I think, that song of Peter Wingard's, I told you, you know, it's very offensive to many people. I will say this, you know, for obvious reasons, the one people that escape are the Jews. They're in that particular song. You just got to listen to it to believe it.
I prefer Tom Lehrer's song, International Brotherhood Week, but maybe I will track that. I assume that song is not on YouTube. Maybe I can find it on the dark web.
No. It's on YouTube. Trust me.
Oh, good Lord. I'm sure the comments are gold.
I don't recall reading the comments, but I can find the link and I'll send it to you.
I am most definitely not putting that in the show notes. To my audience, you will not find a link to that song in the show notes. You can find it on your own or you can text Barsky. He will tell you. I will not.
It's not too hard. There's this thing called Google. They got it for computers now, I hear.
Jim Sangster has done many wonderful song parodies and original compositions for this show. I will never ask Jim to perform that song.
Well, he may do it on his own. You never know. Although I think he's a man of much more refined taste than that.
I would like to think that he would not. Jim, yeah. Don't disappoint me, buddy.
Yeah.
So I like Planet of Fire. I like that all this stuff is going on. I like that part four has this real urgency because you have Turlough leaving. You have Chameleon leaving. You have the annual quote-unquote final story for the Master in which he dies in horrific fashion and then comes back unscathed in the next story with no explanation as to how he got out of the fire at all. I love the idea of numismaton gas. I love the idea that Sarn was colonized to be a healing center for these rich colonialist overlords.
Yeah.
And then there's turmoil on their home planet and they have to give up the colony and they leave the colony to its own devices. And this weird sort of South Seas World War II island mythology builds up around what the Trions left behind so that the volcanologist fire outfit becomes Logar and they literally turn a religion out of it. I think this story has a lot of neat things to say about religion and colonialism, and Anthony Ainley makes the story a lot better. The part three cliffhanger is bonkers, but I think it works really well because you could expect many things to happen. You would never expect a box to open and a pint-sized Master, having nearly destroyed himself, showing up squeaking out, "You may have escaped my slave, but you will obey me or die." I think it's wonderful.
Well, I got – it is, and I appreciate it much more. But again, back in 1984, when I first saw this, I was just so sick of certain science fiction tropes, the primitives who worship the fire god and miniaturized villains and things like that. You know, it was another thing that just turned me off of this serial. And I actually appreciate it a lot more, you know, as I get deeper into, you know, the minutiae of these shows and read the novelizations. And as I said, this, you know, one of the reasons why I choose some of the books for this podcast is so I can appreciate what I don't like. I said that about Rebus Operation. Well, that didn't help very much, the novelization there, but this one did. This one did. I just think Grimwade is just an incredible author, and what he does with the material, you know, it helps that he knows the material very well, but what he does with it really enriches what was televised.
No, you talk about being sick of certain sci-fi tropes, bearing in mind that you're 14 years old. 14-year-old boys are very, very cynical. Now that we are much, much older, in our mid to late 30s respectively, I think we have a little more charity for some of these ideas if they're carried off well. Doctor Who has done this before. They have done the devolved civilization that mm-hmm. worships and sacrifices.
Yep.
Timonov and Malkon and the others kind of humanize this. And I think it's done very well in the story. You compare this to Face of Evil is great science fiction. Face of Evil is always held up as one of Doctor Who's greatest stories. I think there's more heart and soul in this story than in Face of Evil, where all the characters are kept at a remove. And apart from Leela, there's really nobody heroic or sympathetic. I think this story has a little more to have affection for than does Face of Evil. Maybe yes. That's a heretical opinion. Send me to the fire with Logar, but I think this is a little better.
I know. I you know what? Now that, you know, I've rewatched it for this podcast and read the book, I will agree with you on certain terms. I do believe that the relationships the characters have with each other in Planet of Fire is far more important and much deeper and enriches your experience watching the program. You got Timonov and the Chosen One. You have, you know, obviously Turlough finding out his origins are coming back to him, and you got his brother. And again, as we already pointed out, his relationship with the Doctor is also starting to get a little strained again with this. You know, Turlough, they started really writing for Turlough, of course, you know, frothing at the mouth aside, and Frontios, that was a great story for him.
Mark Strickson can handle anything you give him. And when I did my big rewatch during the pandemic, I came away with so much more respect. I didn't pay a lot of attention to Turlough, you know, when I was a teenager, because, you know, again, you're looking more for, at least for me, I was looking more for bikinis than for Turlough and Speedos. I think he really crushes the story. I think it's a top performance. Now, this, of course, gives rise to the unauthorized sequel, Turlough and the Earthlink Dilemma, which is coming up on the show in a few months. I own it. I have never read it. Ooh. I am told it is one of the worst bits of literature ever committed to paper, even worse than Charles Dickens's Martin Chuzzlewit. I'm going to read it for this podcast. I'm curious to see, reading it as if Mark Strickson is acting it in my head, I'm curious if that's really as bad as everyone says it is.
Well, I mean, Grimwade didn't write it, so it could very well be. It's a shame that they didn't let him write that. You know, going back to what you said about Strickson as a great actor, it's like even Sayward says that in some of the BTS materials. He's like, man, this guy's acting his socks off. Why didn't I write for him more? Why didn't we use him more?
Yeah.
It's a real shame, and he's absolutely right. I was really annoyed by Turl when he first showed up, because I just, again, a science fiction trope of, you know, somebody on the ship, you know, being a saboteur and all that crap. But I really grew to like him over the years.
And it wasn't a trope that we'd seen in Doctor Who before, the antagonist companion.
No, but, you know, I've watched enough at this point. I mean, you've seen it a couple times on Star Trek, and you've seen it, you know, everywhere else. I mean, I just, yeah, not for me. But no, I appreciate more. I appreciate his arc more. And yeah, in this season, you know, he's particularly great. And by the way, I happen to really like Warriors of the Deep. You know, you kind of, you know, defamed it, bookending it with, including it with the bookends of the Twin Dilemma in the series. But, you know, I think it's good. I mean, sure, the Murka is a mess. But, you know, again, I'll say it once, say it a thousand times, you know, You got to suspend your disbelief, you know, with some of these special effects, and if you got a problem with special effects, you know, I think you lack imagination. If you lack imagination, why are you watching Doctor Who in the first place? You know,
they're not filming in the volume. This is black box theater, so I have no problem. I have been a vocal defender of Warriors of the Deep, first on somebody else's podcast in 2021, and then on my own show, episode 87. Mm-hmm. I will always go to bat for Warriors of the Deep. It is not the best story of season 21. I think much of season 21 is better than Warriors of the Deep, but I like Warriors. And Johnny Byrne we found his post on RecArt's Doctor Who. He was very critical of what was done to the story by Eric Saward and by Pennant Roberts. He was never, as far as I know, able to find his original drafts. It would be interesting to do a to hear a Big Finish adaptation of the original drafts of Warriors of the Deep. I don't know if they exist. I think that story is unfairly criticized. It's kind of made the scapegoat. If you're criticizing the special effects of Doctor Who, the Murka sort of stands as shorthand for everything.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's unfair. I think there are much worse effects than the Murka. I think there's worse acting in other stories. I think there's worse lighting in other stories.
Oh, yeah.
And again, I'm a Doctor Who for the words, not for the special effects. I like Warriors.
Yeah. Always have. Same here. And to maybe segue into part two of my continual rant against the upgraded, quote-unquote, special effects in the DVDs. I don't know if you recall that the side-by-side comparison they did. Did they do that actually? Or my thing is, the fire effects, you know, that they did for the Planet of Fire on the DVD. It's like, they don't make sense for like two reasons. You know, first of all, narratively, I mean, I always assume that this part in the history of Sarn, it was more, you know, it was a quieter planet. You know, the volcanics had simmered down a bit. It's more of a cinder right now. I mean, the guys look into the volcano mount. They don't see anything. It's still hot, but it's quieter seismically. And yet they put these flames all over, like, those scenes on the volcanic rock that Perry's running around, and there's even a giant flaming rock when Timonoff is talking to, you know, what's his name, the chosen one on the balcony. Malcolm. Yeah, of course. So, and I don't know anybody, you know, for the second reason, it doesn't make sense. I mean, if you've ever been near flames, you can't have a full conversation 10 feet away from them, especially ones that are 20 feet high. And not to mention, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of people, I know this because of my own experience. I mean, I've literally walked on volcanic rock with lava 2 feet under the rock, and my shoes melted just standing there. And the heat is so intense. You cannot be there. You cannot get that close to heat, volcanic heat, with a protective suit. And I'm just like, this is just so stupid. And they're literally prancing all over the place. And it's like, just happens to be erupting in front of them and beyond them. It's just dumb.
I have walked across dried lava flow. I've been to Volcanoes National Park in Hawaii. I've walked as close to Kilauea as you can get. I love the sound of footsteps on volcanic ash. But what were you doing that your shoes melted? Was that for a TV episode, or was that just for your own?
Well, yeah, it was in 2005. We did a thing on volcanology in that same park in Hawaii on the Big Island, and we were shooting Dirty Jobs, and you know, we went with the volcanologist, actually took a rod and stuck it into the hot lava to collect the sample. We did, and even with a thermal suit on, you can feel the heat intensely. We didn't wear the cameraman and I. We didn't wear that stuff, so we didn't get as close because we just couldn't. I mean, we were getting sunburns just standing there. But if you're standing in place, I mean, your tennis shoes melted right on the.
Did you get the host of Dirty Jobs to say praise be to Logar as you walk by in a volcanologist suit?
It's one of the few lines that I threw at him that he actually denied saying. I don't know why.
I've seen the episode on Hawaii where you guys were cleaning windows on the side of a skyscraper and he signed your name on the release form. That's my earliest memory of you.
Jesus.
David Marcy.
Yeah, no, that was like 5 years later. That was in Honolulu, actually. That was we got nominated because of that episode for the third time, I think. As an Emmy nominated, I should say.
Not to drop the word Emmy nomination lightly.
No, well, I said nominated. I don't know. Just I don't know, for clarity's sake.
That's more than Eric Saward will ever have.
Yeah. That's because he didn't use Mark Strickson enough, right?
All right, let's play some 20 questions. Now, since we are not in the same room, I cannot play with the Devil's Head Nick of Time napkin dispenser. But I can ask you, using 20 yes or no questions, which Doctor Who story between 1963 and 2022, randomly selected from the archives, am I?
Well, are you a classic Doctor Who episode?
I'm surprised you didn't go for the Hail Mary this time, but yes, I am a classic Doctor Who episode.
Oh, God. Better not be full circle this time, I'll tell you that.
it wasn't for Andrew Smith. It's not going to be for you.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, I mean, am I in color?
Yes, we are in color.
That's terrible.
We've narrowed it down to two decades, 70s and 80s. Question three.
Yeah. All right. Was I broadcast in the 70s?
Yes, I was broadcast in the 70s.
Okay.
Question four.
Did you star the third Doctor?
No, I did not star the third Doctor. That brings us to question number five.
Yeah. Was Sarah Jane Smith a companion?
No, Sarah Jane Smith was not a companion. Question six. I wish she was.
Was Romana One a companion?
No, I am not a Romana One story. Question seven.
Oh, it's killing me. Was Leela the companion?
Yes, Leela was the companion. Question eight.
Are you a season 15 story?
No, I am not a season 15 story. So now you're at the inflection point. Question nine, you have more choices remaining than stories from which to choose.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's always good, right?
You're guaranteed to win. You're not getting to Bill Evenson territory today.
Nobody ever will.
Or ChatGPT territory, heaven forfend.
Oh yeah, that was pretty bad, wasn't it?
I'm less worried about ChatGPT taking my job now that I know it can't play 20 questions.
It can't?
Evidently not. Question nine.
Oh God! All right. Well, it's helpful that. All right. So, are you the robot to death?
No, I am not the robot.
Are you the talented Wang Chiang?
That should have been your Hail Mary, it being your favorite. From where you are sitting, the Talons of Wang Chiang photo or framed portrait is very close to where you're sitting. But no, question 10, I am not Talons.
Oh my God.
I may as well give you – you're guaranteed to win. I may as well give you a hint. Had you already played Hail Mary based upon a story that we discussed earlier in this hour, you would have had it.
Yeah, I know. Well, you're the face of evil.
I am the face of evil. I sit here with a goofy smirk on my face in my kitchen. No, I am the face of evil.
That is, honestly, I couldn't read your face this time like I have in the past, and you didn't give it away. So
and
good for you.
I knew going into this recording that the face of evil was going to be the answer, but when I brought it up, I didn't bring it up to tease you. I actually brought it up because it does organically relate to Planet of Fire. Speaking of the awesomeness of Peter Grimwade, he is a fan, all right? He actually works back in this book to mention that Sarn is similar to Karn and that the numismaton gas flame is similar to the elixir of life. Peter Grimwade loved this show, and it is a shame that J&T blackballed him because a guy who can put that in his novelization is a friend of mine.
Yeah, no, I mean, hey, I mean – but honestly, I read another for this podcast to prepare for this podcast. I read another W.H. Allen book. Did you?
I did not. Did you read The Comeuppance of Captain Cat?
No. Was there an actual? There's no book of that, is there?
I know that he wrote a book with his Doctor Who contract that wasn't Doctor Who. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, it's called Robot.
Robot. Oh, wow, by Peter Grimwade.
And honest to God, when you were here, you looked at the shelf that this was sitting on, but you didn't see it. But it is laugh out loud funny. I mean, wow. The first chapter like contains, again, too many science fiction tropes that you could possibly name. But it has so many references to Doctor Who, including, you know, a place name that is Turlo, you know. The robot developed by the the military that fails when it turns on and wants to kill, says exterminate, exterminate. Ha. And some character says, oh, that's real original. it's really funny. And he actually name drops Doctor Who, a character, you know, a young boy is taken over by an alien consciousness, and he is able to build robot. And, you know, when he's telling an adult about his plans, say, let's see how you do with your Doctor Who robot or whatever it is. It's really funny. But given what you said about how Grimwade is a fan, it's absolutely true. The young kid's name is actually God, what the heck was it? I just read this damn book. Ptolemy. And you know, the sort of place names as generational names that comes into play, and say Image of the Fendelman,
yes,
is also present in this book.
Huh.
It's pretty interesting. Yeah. There's an ancient mound that the aliens had occupied at one point, and it's called Ptolemy's something or other. And the kid is named Ptolemy.
If that's not a science fiction cliche that would make 14-year-old Barsky gnash his teeth.
It would have, but, you know, as a guy who's, you know, reading this now and appreciating, you know, the humor that he's ejecting into this, it's really and he also references Pip and Jane Baker offhand. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's really funny. It's really funny.
Next time I am in North Hollywood and shopping in Iliad Books, I will see if they have it in their massively overstocked sci-fi collection.
They do. That's actually where I discovered it. I discovered it there, but I didn't buy it because the back cover of that copy is half of it's ripped off and it's in bad shape. And I actually took a picture of it and I posted on one of the groups on Facebook a couple of years ago when I first discovered it. And then I said, you know what? Since I'm doing the Grimwade episode, I'm gonna buy it this time. I got it on eBay and I read it before I read Planet of Fire.
Well, this is sadly the last Peter Grimwade episode of Doctor Who Literature, unless, of course, I go back around and redo the pilgrimage with different guests in a few years. But fortunately, this is not the last David Barsky episode, because you're going to be doing one for each Doctor. So we will be seeing you again after the Doctor changes over.
Yep, I got a few breaks, so I mean, the turnaround isn't as quick as this one, that's for sure.
Yeah, your next episode after this is practically half a year away, but then you're coming up several times after that.
Yeah, I got three more after that.
I've got four. I've got you down for four more, but I won't say which ones to
surprise you. What have I forgotten?
I've got you down for a Hartnell. I've got you down for a Troughton. I've got you down for a Colin Baker, and I've got you down for a Silve.
No, you got me for four more after this one.
Yeah, four more. Yes, four more after this one.
The Colin Baker one's next, right?
Well, you might well think that, but I'm not going to spoil it for the audience. But no, the Colin Baker one is...
No, I'm pretty sure it is.
Not, in fact, next. There's another book before. There's two other books before the Colin.
What? Are you serious? I don't think you're right, man. We don't have to discuss this and give it away for the audience, as you say.
There's a specific reason why I'm doing it the way, but these books are being reviewed in publication order, not in commission order. That should be a hint.
No, I know. I'm pretty sure. Okay. We can discuss this offline, then. I'm very surprised.
I will leave the audience on a cliffhanger.
You're leaving me on a cliffhanger. What are you talking about?
I'll be speaking to you once I press stop on the recording. That's like 90 seconds from now. The audience will have to wait a lot longer. Any new acquisitions to your home library that we want to talk about before I let you go?
Oh, my God. I got all kinds of stuff. Nothing specifically Doctor Who, although I got a couple volumes from our friend Jason Davis, who does the Babylon 5 stuff.
Yes.
He's, you know, it's actually, God, they know how to make money with that stuff, you know, people like me, because there's hardcover versions of certain publications they had, and they made softcover versions and included a bonus volume, which I had to have. And I bought everything else involved. But Doctor Who wise, I don't think I got anything recently. No, but I did get the Making of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan book, and that's pretty awesome.
Ooh, I have Nicholas Meyer's autobiography. I don't know if I have The Making of Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Barsky is stepping away from his desk to explore his library and show me a volume. And as he stands up, I can see Yoda on the shelf behind him where he vacated.
Oh, yes. Yes. I'm surprised you didn't see. Which one? Wait a minute. I got two Yodas behind me, actually. See the little one?
No, the larger one, three shelves down.
Oh, yeah. Okay. There you go. Yeah, no, nothing Doctor Who related. You know, I got some Universal horror stuff. I got I got this
hard to find volume on Toho's complete filmography.
Oh wow! I did ask you to tell me how close you were to Vasquez Rocks, and you told me to watch the 1935 Wolfman movie with Henry Hall. And sure enough, that takes place with Vasquez Rocks doubling for Tibet.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of crazy what doubles Tibet. You know, it's certainly I don't know. You got to compare it to. Snowden, or what is it? What do they call that?
Snowdonia.
Snowdonia, of course. It's a weird freaking name. But
all I know is I watched three Henry Hall movies in a 15-day stretch, because before I came to you, I watched both High Sierra and its unofficial remake, Colorado Territory, both with Henry Hall. And then on the other side of visiting you, I watched the 1935 Wolfman movie. So that's a lot of Henry Hall.
Well, any of those movies, they could have used the Vasquez Rocks for those locations. You never know.
Maybe not Colorado Territory, but certainly High Sierra.
Well, yeah, but there's certainly, I mean, if they use it for the Himalayas, they can use it for the Colorado Rockies.
Or for Star Trek. All right, David Barsky, we will see you again, my friend. Have a great night.
All right, thanks again. It's always wonderful. I really appreciate you having me on this podcast, Jason.
Planet of Fire by Peter Grimwade, televised as Planet of Fire, teleplay by Peter Grimwade, televised in February and March 1984, paperback release date January 17th, 1985, target book number 93, cover artist Andrew Skilleter. The Doctor is enjoying the sun on a holiday island, but things are soon hotter than he bargained for. The young American, Perpigillium Brown, brings to the TARDIS a mysterious object that her archaeologist stepfather has found in a sunken wreck. Chameleon, the Doctor's robot friend of a thousand disguises, reacts to the object totally unexpectedly, with bewildering consequences for the TARDIS crew. For Chameleon sends the Doctor and his friends to Sarn, a terrifyingly beautiful planet of fire. This strange world provides the key to Turlough's secret past, and once again the Doctor is pitted against the wily Master. The opening chapter of Planet of Fire is basically a short story, telling the interlinked fates of two shipwrecks, a Greek trireme of antiquity, bearing a precious cargo of fine art and slaves, capsizes in a storm off a tropical island, with a merchant clinging to his valuable kouros as it's lost beneath the waves, and a starship, carrying a not-so-precious cargo of slaves, is brought down by a magnetic storm over the planet Sarn, but not before releasing a rescue beacon into the stars. On board the ship is the father and baby brother of one Vizlor Turlough. We, the reader, know that both the kouros and the rescue beacon will wind up commingled on the ocean bed off the island of Lanzarote. At least that's my take, if not Barsky's. But Grimwade match-cutting the two shipwrecks, neither of which were shown on screen, is a minor thing of beauty. Planet of Fire on TV suffers a bit from being a nightmare brief. Every week, Peter Grimwade had some new demands thrust upon his in-progress scripts. It's meant to be Turlough's final story, wrapping up his mystery arc and sending him out on a high note. But wait! You also have to write out Chameleon. Who the bleep is Chameleon? One can imagine Grimwade asking. And we need a new companion, an American, so J&T can have someone to show off at U.S. conventions. Why does Perry sound Australian? One can imagine Grimwade asking. And you need to include the Master. Oh, and you have to set 25 minutes of outdoor footage on Lanzarote, where the author had never even been, and where he was not invited along on the production shoot. In the novelization, though, Grimwade makes all of this work, as if he'd conceived of every story strand himself. His prose is remarkably good. He's devoid of the run-on sentences that tended to plague target books not written by Terence Dix, He always finds terrific vocabulary words. Chameleon, quote, the aristocrat of automata. Here uses the word inexactitude. The words nabob and grand panjandrum both appear. Grimwade's prose deftly weaves in little continuity references. In chapter 2, we get a reference to the leisure hive and a lengthy eulogy, simultaneously fond and sarcastic, to the just-departed Tegan. The similar plot of the Brain of Morbius is openly acknowledged, and Grimwade quotes directly from Legopolis, which he directed, in describing the mini-master as cut down to size. Grimwade calls back to Canine and his cheerful loyalty, against which Chameleon, this tinpot Jeeves, unquote, is negatively compared. TV dialogue is converted into prose and internal thought processes, a technique well used by Christopher H. Bidmead in past novelizations. And Grimwade is just funny. The Doctor, quote, viewed the prospect of a vacation as only marginally less calamitous than the eruption of Krakatoa. That's both a witty line and anticipates the volcanic plot. The description of Timonov and his elders as arthritic Ayatollahs is a funny bit of alliteration and laugh-out-loud description that is criminally wasted in a book this short and out of print. Grimwade dips back and forth among a dizzying array of POV. Mindful that this is Turlough's book, we're clued in much earlier than on TV that Turlough was trying to avoid the Tryon distress signal, still broadcasting across the years from the Greek shipwreck off the African coast. What appeared to be random shiftiness in the early going on TV is all spelled out quite clearly in the book. We get a rare POV shot from inside Chameleon's head as he lies to the Doctor but can't figure out why. Timonov has a series of darkly comic complaints about his inexperienced chosen one. Then one of his acolytes has, quote, a hearty dislike of all liberals and freethinkers. Grimwade's Perry, with her memories of Bloomingdale's and the Harlem Globetrotters, is far more American than the TV character ever was. The Master is more appalled to be defeated by an American than by an Earthling. There is unbridled glee from the Master when he realizes he can exploit the superstitious elders of Sarn with their penchant for execution by burning and their laser gun staffs. Deification, he decided, was no more than his due. And Professor Howard Foster is given the benefit of the doubt. We learn that he likes and respects his stepdaughter, Perry, even as their one conversation together craters into a bitter argument. I am raising a 13-year-old. I can relate. Fandom has long suspected in certain corners that Howard abused Perry when she was younger, but I honestly don't see any of that in the text here. And the Doctor twice desires the archaeologist's presence on Sarn, long after the professor himself has disappeared from the plot. Sarn, quote, reminded him, the professor would surely have agreed, of the old Roman city of Ephesus. You'd figure that Grimwade featured Foster more heavily in the original concept, with such lines as, Chameleon had enjoyed being Professor Foster. There was order, logic, and, as one would expect, from the survivor of so many faculty purges, a vein of pure ruthlessness, before all the added plot demands forced him to rewrite those scenes with other characters instead. Grimwade gets style points for adding more ancient Greek flavor to the rest of the story, even though the Greek shipwreck is only the most minor of plot devices. Perry, momentarily stranded on a boat, is said to be madder than Ariadne, abandoned on Naxos. A queue of Sarn citizens marches, quote, like pious Athenians, on the sacred way to the Acropolis. Beyond the ancient Greeks, Turlough quotes briefly from Dante, and at length from Paradise Lost, see again Christopher H. Bidmead and Legopolis, which Grimwade directed, and Grimwade happily references two minor characters from his own Maudrin on Dead, Turlough's debut story. Chapter titles are great, too. A Very Uncivil Servant is a witty introduction to Chameleon's first turn as the Master. And then there's this, quote, when Moses came down the mountain to find the Israelites dancing around a golden calf, he must have looked something like Timonov as he strode through the Hall of Fire towards the impious stranger who was desecrating the precious relics. Seize the enemy of Logar, shouted the white-haired patriarch. Arrest all unbelievers. The action is somewhat slimmed down from TV. Back in the 80s, you needed to film X percent of your story on location to justify the cost of an overseas shoot, which resulted in a lot of languorous beauty shots of Lanzarote. Grimwade for the book cuts most of that out not even identifying Lanzarote by name, surely revenge for not being allowed to go, and simplifying business, such as Turlough's short shorts rescue of Perry, or the Doctor paying for his drink with alien currency. All the sorry material from Part 1 is delayed for the book, which opens as broadcast with 5 full minutes of location footage, all of which is moved back and regrouped into Chapter 4 here for better narrative flow. Grimwade adds a makeshift cemetery from the long-dead spaceship crash victims, including Turlough's family, and has Turlough weeping over it, a nice character moment that is not present on television. There's lots of other added material. I say added, but I expect this is scripted dialogue, cut for TV and restored for the novelization. There's more about Timonov having been an unbeliever in his youth. Then we get an explanation for why the Trion stopped visiting Sarn. Like the BBC, intergalactic empires also have budget cuts. Timonov gets a happy ending, as Barsky and I discussed, and I prefer this to Peter Wingard's stubborn exit on TV. We learn just what the Doctor is thinking as the Master dies, and the Master's ambiguous and poorly heard final line, a Sayward penned overdub added in post-production and not very audible, is not on the book, and I don't miss it. One of Grimwade's skills is to make humorous remarks about the story while keeping it serious without descending into parody. Perry likens the volcano control room to the hall of the Mountain King's boiler room, a genuinely funny line, one of several. On the other hand, Turlough displaying his criminal brand, sacred to Sarns, in what's described as a literal Nazi salute, is problematic. Speaking of Nazis, there's an intriguing look here at what Turlough might have become, had Civil War not turned him into a political prisoner, an exile. He's openly scornful of the egalitarian regime that ousted his family from power on Trion, leaving the Doctor to wonder, quote, what sort of monster his companion would have become had he continued to be brought up as the scion of an aristocratic ruling family. Echoes of this are present on TV, at least in the way that Peter Davison and Mark Strickson choose to interpret the lines in the final camera script.
The Master must have precipitated an eruption.
I don't think so. That isn't an eruption.
No, it's blue flame. It hasn't been seen for many generations.
What is it supposed to indicate?
It's a sign of great favor from Rogar. He's showing his mercy to the sick and the injured. There'll be a gathering. We must go to our people.
I wonder if Rogar will help a sick Time Lord. Perhaps the Master needs the blue flame more than the people of Sarn.
We should get back to the bunker.
No. The Hall of Fire. I want to analyze the deposit on the walls. Unless, of course, you can tell me what it is.
How should I know? That cave's part of a colonial civilization that ended ages ago.
The control center's been maintained. Just what sort of interest have your people got in the stability of an abandoned planet?
I don't know.
When we arrived, you expected to find Trions here. Why?
The triangle here in the ruin.
If this is an abandoned planet, what was your father doing here? All right. But if you're holding back anything that will aid the Master, our friendship is at an end. Is that understood?
Yes, Doctor.
And fair is fair. Barsky and I did make some comments at Peter Wingard's expense earlier in the show. He does give a remarkably good performance here, a portion of which was heard in that audio clip from Part 3. For all the book's wit and narrative improvements and intelligent references to Who continuity and Greek mythology, Grimwade got just one thing wrong. Just one thing. As Turlough leaves the TARDIS forever, he reflects on newcomer Perry. The cheery American would make an admirable companion. And that's where the book ends, with Turlough's departure. The TV episode goes on for one more scene, which I suspect was written by Eric Sayward. A single scene in the TARDIS between the Doctor and his new companion, Perry. But that's only one scene, the audio from which I will play in a moment. However, season 22 is coming, just around the corner. So Turlough's remark about Perry being an admirable companion, we'll see about that. We'll see about that, indeed.
It's funny, but just before I I met you, I was saying I wanted to travel, and I've still got 3 months of my vacation left.
And you want to travel with me?
Is that an invitation?
Actually, it was a question.
May I?
3 months, you say?
That's right.
All right. Why not? Welcome aboard, Perry.
Next time on Doctor Who Literature, we come to the end of the Peter Davison era. Not the end of the Peter Davison novelizations, but the end of the Peter Davison era with the novelization of Peter's final televised story and the penultimate story of season 21, a story that in the past has topped the DWM poll for the greatest Doctor Who story of all time, and a story that it's quite possible you will hear more about when I do my top 60 for 60 episode in November 2023. A television story this epic, and a Terence Dicks novelization so grand, requires a special kind of guest for the week. Joining me is the man who wrote the production notes commentary for the most recent release of the Caves of Androzani DVD, as well as many other DVD production notes, including a brand new production note script written for the new release of The Five Doctors on the Season 20 Blu-ray Collection box set. Once again, coming back to Doctor Who Literature, is a longtime listener too, supporter of the show, and a good friend of mine, Paul Schoons, to discuss Doctor Who, The Caves of Androzani, next week on Doctor Who Literature. Thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature podcast. This podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, David Barsky. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter at Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, on Mastodon and Blue Sky, also at Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.